So we're going to move on and talk about gynecologic cancers, a lot to talk about there. It's always fun to see Dave O'Malley rushing up to me and say, I'm sorry, I got the slides too late, but there was this presentation last week.
Good job.
I can't wait to hear about this. Pembro plus olaparib in ovarian cancer. That sounds pretty interesting. And our co-moderator, Dr. Monk, who has been part of our CME programs for many, many years, a very valuable faculty person. He's now in a high position in research and FCS and agreed to co-moderate and throw a few questions out to you all. So we're going to begin talking about ovarian cancer. Dave, I'm going to let you begin and go through some of the data related to treatment of this disease. There's been a lot of great developments over the last 5 years, and we're seeing even more now. And also to get into something that we're talking about now, and you know, the GU symposium, the GI symposium, which is HER2-positive disease. And you know, now with the pan-tumor approval of T-DXd, HER2 has become an issue almost in every solid tumor, plus other anti-HER strategies. So Dave, let's go through some of the data.
Well, thanks for having me, and really appreciate seeing everybody today. Really excited to discuss some of this new data and some of the older data. We really have three main questions we ask in first-line ovarian cancer. Should we use neoadjuvant or primary debulking? Should we use Bev? The decisions we have to make right when we meet the patient. Based on those decisions, then we have to make decisions once we've completed, which we started calling it induction chemotherapy. I don't know if I like that term, but it's the cytotoxic chemotherapy with or without Bev. Then the next decision is, do we add PARP inhibitors? But that paradigm is being called into question with some recent data that we'll get into. One of the things we really were worried about in looking at groups of patients were PARP inhibitors actually hurting some of our overall survival based on most likely some induction of platinum resistance. So the PRIMA data was just presented by Antonio Gonzalez-Martin at last year's ESMO, which really we looked at that group of patients, a high-risk first-line ovarian cancer patients who were randomized to niraparib versus placebo. And this is the update. Now we have 6 years of survival. And on the far left, you see the overall population, but really look at the HRD and the HRD test negative or HRP population. I want to call your question into now, again, 6 years of median follow-up and where the tails of the curve here are. These are patients that most likely are cured beyond at this point. This is progression-free survival. And you see that you have more than doubling of those that have not recurred in the HRD population. But unfortunately, we haven't seen that same benefit in our HRD test negative or HRP population. And we also presented the overall survival. I tried to compare as best I could apples to apples here, looking at the HRD population. And the far left is the PRIMA overall population, where you see no difference in the overall survival. Now, I had to take out the slide that really compared the crossover rate across these different trials. But look in the far right, SOLO-1, the oldest of these trials, the crossover rate much less because PARP inhibitors were not available at times in the U.S. and definitely in Europe. Actually, presentation Dr. Monk did with Edithena Mono also showing a benefit, but not as long a follow-up, similar overall survival. And Apollo-1, again, the second oldest trial here, showing the benefit in the active comparator, Bev-containing arm as the control, so a little bit different. Basically, early on when we didn't have follow-up, we saw clear overall survival benefit, even though not hitting statistical significance because of the limited alpha allocated. But we're now seeing that there's not detriment, which we were worried about due to the concern of induction of resistance. So DUO-O was actually presented last year. DUO-O three-arm trial. All the trials we discussed are going to be carboplatin backbone. And then utilizing now IO agents or PARP inhibitor or the combination. That's exactly what DUO-O. So we presented this last year, and we weren't very excited about it. And then the updated here was this past ESMO, and we see that there is some difference, but the comparator arm is wrong. It's a control here. We know the comparator arm should be either Bev or the comparator arm should be PARP. In this case, we have all patients in DUO receiving Bev, again, different than the other trials. So we weren't very excited about these results. And just to remind you, when we look at the HRD test negative on the right, we see that there may be a hint there. And I brought that up last year when we discussed that. And the HRD test positive, we're really just looking at probably the benefit of PARP inhibitors, but not much benefit added of DERVA. Again, when we look at these groups, you see the overlap across there. So there wasn't much excitement. Brad actually presented the Atheno combo arm at last year, looking at rucaparib, another one of the PARP inhibitors, comparing rucaparib nevo in this instant, and the active question was against rucaparib by itself. And you see here the combination of all three arms that we looked at. So the bottom is the placebo, the middle is rucaparib nevo, and the top is rucaparib. So actually, we saw potentially harm here. And we look at this group, some of us wanted to utilize PD-L1 testing as a primary analysis. But even in that group of patients, we're not seeing any difference. So the question really was, at that point, we're like, okay, it's dead. IO is dead in the first line ovarian cancer. Then we had two press releases within 2 weeks of each other this past December telling us the first trial, which is looking at niraparib, okay, versus and Keylink, which we'll go over more into. So both these trials were announced negative. Both the comparison, the unique thing about first, we're looking forward to seeing that this year, is that the comparator arm is PARP inhibitors, while Keylink, the comparator arm, was placebo. And when we look at this group, the reason I kept this slide in here is to show you that 50% were CPS positive, greater than or equal to 10, okay? And at the bottom, about 45% had received Bev. This one was physician's choice. And we look here, I use these slides from the presentation. So P is not placebo, it's Pembro with olaparib versus C is control. And you see the primary analysis on the left is the first interim and on the right is the final analysis, showing a clear benefit in the CPS population greater than 10. Seeing a similar benefit, but not quite there in the intent to treat. But when we look at this group of patients in the forest plot, we see some hints where could this potentially benefit be. On the left, we look down at the Bev use, overlaps of those confidence intervals, but maybe a potential benefit, and we look over here in the intent to treat. So now we look at the Pembro versus control, and you see there's no benefit. Remember that this was the control arm was placebo. Now when we look at we're using Foundation Medicine's LOH test as the primary analysis, we see in this group greater than 10, again, not really any difference in the forest plot, but as we go through and look at those with Bev or not Bev, it's very interesting. Again, exploratory here, but we're seeing a group of patients that may have a greater benefit, those that did not receive Bev. Now we'll talk more about this in the discussion, but really, again, exploratory analysis. When we look at the group that is Pembro versus control, again, looking at those in LOH low or HRD test negative, you see potentially some additional benefit. That group of patients is the highest unmet need. This is really interesting, where we see detriment at those with Bev, again, exploratory, not statistically significant, obviously, but we see a marked benefit of 0.53 with regards to the hazard ratio in those with no Bev in the intent and just in the placebo. So there may be a signal there. Obviously, this was not tested on this trial. So as we go through and look at overall survival, we see, again, some benefits. Now, let's switch gears a little bit, move from first line to the recurrent setting. So folate receptor alpha, obviously, we're all excited about this. We talked the last couple of years about MIRV, in Mirasol, and not only did we have improvement, a 0.65 hazard ratio, modest median progression-free survivals, but that translated to overall survival. And that led to full FDA approval then last year. A recent trial that was presented by Angeles Alvarez-Secord looked at a unique patient population of platinum-sensitive patients who were candidates for single-agent therapy. And what would those be? Patients with heavy hypersensitivity, or those that have had trouble tolerating platinum's usually hematologic toxicity. So it's a single-arm trial, so it's hard to make conclusions, but if you look at over on the left, the overall response rates you see for more heavily pretreated is about 33%, but in the less heavily pretreated, we see about a 50-55% response rate. How does that compare to our historical controls? You expect about right in there 55-60 with our platinum doublets. So we have a single agent therapy with similar populations. We've also identified a patient which may be at a higher risk of this of not responding as well, as I alluded to earlier, those that have progressed on PARP inhibitor. And you see in the middle, those that had been treated with a PARP inhibitor, those who have not been treated with the PARP inhibitor, the difference in the response rates. But we would see similar differences if we looked at the platinum. So we now potentially have an option in patients who are not eligible for a platinum doublet. And you just heard on HER2. So how often do we see HER2 expression in our GYN cancers? And actually, in endometrial, if you look at all patients, about 60%, obviously lower in 3+, but also over in cervical, right there in that 40% range. And we've all seen the pan-destiny. I won't go into that too much. That led to the agnostic approval in the 3+, but we also had NCCN guidelines for 2+. And we see not only patients responding, but deep and prolonged. But this, to me, is the most interesting. And Neil, you heard me say last year, listen, let's do the math on it. The 2+ versus all comers had the same population. And this is exactly what we saw at last year's IGCS. If you had 0, 1+, or 2+, your response was the same. 3+ clearly was a differentiator across these trials. And I just want to introduce this because I could have done 20 slides just on what's going on in the future. But cadherin 6 is clearly a marker. Katie Moore presented this last year at ESMO, where we saw almost a 50% response rate with almost all patients having disease regression. And that's led to one of the trials that we have in the GOG, which is REJOICE, which we're doing a dose optimization and then a randomization in a platinum-resistant cancer population. Now, this is enrolled so well, we actually had to put it on pause for the dose optimization. We were hopefully going to do a seamless, but because we enrolled so quickly in the phase 2, this trial is currently on pause as we wait for that data to have which dose we're going to move forward to. So thank you for your time. Look forward to the discussion.
So I want to kind of go back to upfront management of ovarian cancer. In a second, I want to see what Brad's doing in his practice and also if he has any questions or any discussion points for the other two here on the stage. But Brian, can you talk a little bit about how you approach a patient who has, you know, BRCA, one or two, upfront, choice of PARP, and whether or not you use Bev?
You know, it's a great question. It's something I think that's still evolving. And thanks for inviting me today, Neil. You know, I think it's clear in those patients with a BRCA mutation in the first line, they need a PARP inhibitor. And traditionally, as far as my choice, I'm either going with olaparib and niraparib. But what's compelling to me and what we're still trying to further elucidate is from the DiPaola data whether or not we should be adding bevacizumab to this population. I've started doing it because I do think that I like the Paola data. I think that there's a benefit there. I haven't seen much more toxicity in adding Bev to that regimen. So in carefully selected patients, those that are, I think, can tolerate an extra drug, those that are maybe a little bit worse disease, I am incorporating the four, but I'm definitely getting the PARP inhibitor in those patients.
So Brad, can you talk a little bit about how you approach it and anything you'd like to hear your colleagues discuss?
Yeah, you know, I thought the densest thing on Earth was the Earth's core. It's your talk, brother. but thank you. That was very comprehensive. Let's break it down. So, Dr. Slomovitz, Brian, good seeing my friends and my FCS friends. Should patients with newly diagnosed advanced ovarian cancer get bevacizumab? Let's just build some consensus right here.
Yes.
Yes.
Wow.
What about HR proficient, Dave?
So absolutely, Bev, at the current time. We really need to dive into the Keylink data And I'm looking forward to further discussions. This was just presented, and to allude to your question, this literally just got back from Rome 2 days ago, where it was presented. So this is fresh off the presses. So I think we need to look at that. But for me, everybody gets Bev, even the low-risk population. We talked about that last year.
Yes.
And if their HRD test negative, I continue Bev as maintenance.
Okay, see how simple that is. Bevacizumab, even if you get neoadjuvant, give it cycle one, cycle two, hold on cycle three, get your surgery. Do you do HIPEC?
Ryan?
I'm just trying to boil things down here and build consensus for my brethren and sisters.
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, Brett. And right now in my practice, I'm not ready for HIPEC. I think we're doing a study. We're further studying in the HOT trial within the GOG. And I know there's data out there. I'm not sure if the contemporary data is comparing it to the right control arms with the best drugs. So I'm not using it. I think that adds its toxicity. I'm a surgeon.
Yeah. Same in Palm Beach.
HIPEC on clinical trial right now is the only time I'm doing HIPEC.
What about this new data with Pembro? And what about where does CPS fit in? Where do you see that heading?
So two things we know, and Dr. O'Malley presented it well. When you add IO to chemotherapy alone, it doesn't work. And the CPS doesn't make it better. When you add a PARP and IO to a tumor microenvironment that we can educate, it does help. Now, there are many variables, HRD and bevacizumab, which we'll have to sort out. But for now, bevacizumab for everyone, HIPEC for no one. And if your HRD test negative, keep the bevacizumab going. And if you're positive, add a olaparib or the other PARP inhibitors. It probably doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I mean, Neil, I think you mentioned the role of Pembro. You know, we're looking at this data as somewhat positive data that we need to further elaborate, but we can't forget the negative phase three trials that were out there. How many trials did we have that were negative that said IO doesn't work? Granted, we're looking at a subset of population, a subset population here, which may pan out, but I'm still not ready to incorporate Pembro into the first line.
And the first data is going to be very telling. We should see the first data this year. We have the press release, so it's either going to be ASCO or ESMO.
So let's tell them what that is. So in this Pembro study that you nicely presented, there was no PARP alone arm. Remember I said Pembro didn't work, you add olaparib to it, it does. Well, there was no olaparib alone arm. The first GSK study, which will probably be presented very soon, is chemotherapy niraparib, our PRIMA study, and then adds dostarlimab to it. So to your point, Brian, all three studies will be looked at in their totality. The Duo-O you presented, the key link that was just in Rome, and the yet to be disclosed, although we have a press release, the first, because they all answer different questions.
The first trial, and it's confusing the way you say it, not the first one. The trial is
called first, which is niraparib and dostarlimab.
And the fifth one that provides our historical context is Paola. So Paola has the Bev PARP olaparib plus the Bev arm.
But no olaparib alone.
But no olaparib alone. First has the PARP inhibitor, Duo-O, which was based on the Mediola data, which I was proud to be one of the leaders in that trial, which just blew it out of the water, which was all three drugs in a platinum sensitive, looked amazing, but then was disappointing here. So the CPS score, I think at one time is going to help us. First, we need to say, can we get access to this drug? Is it going to meet the regulatory hurdle? And if we don't meet the regulatory hurdle, a five-drug combination.
Carboplatin, paclitaxel, pembro, bevacizumab, PARP.
It's a lot. Unless we cure more patients.
Right.
Our one chance for cure is the first-line setting. And so that's where, again, based on the time, I went pretty quickly over those tails of that curve. We're going from our baseline advanced ovarian cancer curative intent is 10, no greater than 15% in an HRD test population.
I want to say two more things. Within FCS, we are big Bev believers, as you are, number one. Number two, the HRD test probably doesn't matter, whether it's Foundation or whether it's Myriad. And under Dr. Gordon's leadership, we now have an in-house HRD, which is based on the Illumina platform, which is good enough. So I like where we're at FCS. I also think that very few of us do HIPEC. So I think the Pembro, IO, durvalumab, dostarlimab is unknown, and we'll continue this conversation.
So Brian, I'm curious about your thoughts in terms of management of HER2 positive disease, also HER2 low. you know, one of the issues there that Dave was presenting was the 2+, mm-hmm. but the breast cancer people say, where's the fish? Right. You guys don't do fish.
Right.
So there may be some HER2, what would breast people call HER2 positive in there. But just for practical purposes, Brian, how are you thinking about when to use a T-DXd? And then I'm curious about your experience with it. We already have talked about this a little bit in the breast session, you know, some of the QTI issues, as well as, of course, the issue of ILD.
Yeah, no, it's a game changer. Trastuzumab deruxtecan in the gynecologic oncology world has been a game changer, and I try to use it as much as I can. We have the FDA approval in the 3+ across the tumors. We have the NCCN listing in 2+ or 3+. And if I was going to predict the future, I think we'll see that activity. You know, GYN likes to follow along what we find in breast. We'll see that activity with the low, with the 1+. Actually, in my practice for some of my endometrial cancer patients, I've gotten insurance approval to pay for it in patients with 1+ disease. So I think we're seeing the activity there. It's better than the other options we have in that setting. We're worried about the side effect profile. You mentioned the ILD. We don't see it very, very often, but we look for it. We watch for it. If there's an early sign or signal of it, I get my multidisciplinary team involved with my pulmonary physicians in particular. But I think it's a game changer, and I think that as far as the testing you mentioned, we could talk about gastric testing, we could talk about breast testing, we could talk about FISH. The way the approval's written, I look for any biopsy across the history of the patient's tumor that's positive. It could be positive when they're diagnosed. I get 4 negative, I'll submit the positive test to the insurance company and I'll get it paid for. That's how much I believe in it.
Right? Yeah, we heard almost the exact same thing from the breast people earlier today. Right. Dave, getting back to, again, GI issues as well as ILD. Again, the breast people are very proactive about using olanzapine, particularly in patients who have GI issues initially. What have you seen in terms of acute nausea and vomiting with T-DXd? The breast people are extremely aggressive about imaging, looking for ILD. They do it like every 9 weeks if they can do it. I don't necessarily see that outside of breast, but I'm curious what you do.
No, you absolutely have to. You have to do imaging of the chest either 9 or 12 weeks. Some people are doing it 6. You know, most of us have trouble getting that approved. Every 3 cycles, everybody should get chest imaging. I've tried to educate with regards to that, and that really will help us. The asymptomatic pneumonitis is real. And you don't want to have one of those grade 5 toxicities that unfortunately we've all seen. You know, I just wanted to kind of, in going back, the T-DXd, I can't disagree with Brian. It's a game changer in a 3+. And the reason I flip back to that numbers is we're talking about 11 patients per arm in PanDestiny-02. We need more data to replicate this. We know early phase trials often over predict what our response rate's going to be. But 3+ seems to be real. But the rest of it, we have to figure it out.
But it's highly emetogenic to what you said. So we use the highly emetogenic chemotherapy, the 3-drug regimen, NK1, 5-HT3 index, and Dex and 5-HT3 on days 2s and 4, and escalate to olanzapine. So we do that. It's in our OncoEMR order set, and we do it just like the breast cancer doctors, like you have taught us.
And it's absolutely. The other thing you have to look for is that, you know, you will see grade 3 diarrhea. So, you know, you control their nausea, but don't forget, and they often present to that week 2. You think they're out of the woods.
That's right.
And then they call you with diarrhea. So lots of different things we have to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on and talk a little bit about endometrial cancer and cervical cancer, Brian.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Neil. And again, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm probably one of the few, if only, I didn't walk here today. I can walk to my office, right? It's a beautiful new cancer center we're building right off of 30.
It is 41st. Incredible, beautiful.
Yeah. Wow. Amazing view.
It's going to be great. So, and thanks for the easy commute. But I think the difference really in endometrial cancer in particular versus ovarian cancer is we're making great strides, and it's probably a little bit less controversial, which is really nice. So we know we're getting a clear answer how to treat our patients. So let's dive into endometrial cancer first, and then we'll go into what's the latest and greatest in cervical cancer. This is traditionally how we treated these patients, carboplatin and paclitaxel. This study took about 7 to 8 years to do. It took about another 7 to 8 years to get it published. But it demonstrates how carboplatin and paclitaxel became the preferred regimen. David Miller led this trial. We could see it was a non-inferiority trial. It beat TAP, not for activity, but in decreased toxicity. And that's how we became the standard of care. PFS median was 13 months, overall survival of 20 months. Clearly, we needed to do better. Then, based on a series, I'm not going into it, but based on the series of the recurrent trials, where we demonstrated that immunotherapy was needed to be given to all patients before they died from their disease. If they were DMMR MSI high, we know the second line data was for single agent pembrolizumab or dostarlimab. If they were MS stable or PMMR proficient, then it was pembrolizumab. We then did a series of trials, four randomized phase three trials, which this summarizes the four, using IO in combination with carboplatin and paclitaxel to see if that could change the world, to see if that could make a difference. Really cool. Our international collaborations allowed us to do four trials at the same time. Even cooler is that we did this during COVID, so we're able to get some trials done during that period of time. Here are the four trials. NRG-018, this was led by Ramez Iskander, looking at pembrolizumab as the IO agent being used. GOG-3031, the RUBY trial, this was led by Dr. Mirza, looking at dostarlimab as the IO agent. There's a part two to this we'll talk about briefly, adding in a PARP inhibitor into this setting. DUO-E, led by Shannon Weston, 3041, looked at durvalumab, and they also looked at PARPs to see if that would play a role in this setting. And finally, the 10 trial, led by Nicoletta Colombo, looking at the PD-L1, atezolizumab, to see its impact difference. Four studies, four positive trials. The two on the left, in March of 2023, they changed the world overnight. One after the one presentations at SGO, simultaneous publication in New England Journal of Medicine. The other two studies look in JCO and Lancet. And here are the results. Here's highlighting the DMMR population, those that are very, very responsive, the hot tumors. You could see here it's a no-brainer. Carboplatin and paclitaxel plus IO agent has hazard ratios as low as 0.28 in the RUBY trial, 0.30 in the GY018. GY018 stands up by itself because it was statistically designed to look at two populations separately, the DMMR and the PMMRs. However, all studies are consistent. We also say one thing here we could say, looking forward, you probably can't get better than these curves. So when we talk about adding PARPs, it'll probably be more for the PMMR population. Here's the PMMR population. We could see not as positive, but still showing a difference. GY018, a hazard ratio of 0.54, RUBY trial 0.76. The summation of these trials led to an all-comer approvals with dostarlimab, all-comer approvals with pembrolizumab, both in the DMMR and the PMMR setting. So what about what can we do? What can we do? And you can see the other agents are listed here, as I said. What can we do better? I don't need to go through this slide. We know what PARP inhibitors are, but can PARP inhibition, in addition to chemotherapy and IO agents, can that make a difference? Two of the trials, parts of the trials, DUO-E looked separately, adding a PARP in addition to the durvalumab. We could see the curves here. When compared to the control arm of chemotherapy, durva alone has the hazard ratio of 0.71, and we saw that to be slightly better, 0.55, with the durvalumab and the olaparib. Not statistically designed to go head-to-head, but when we looked at the data, the hazard ratio of the triplet, the chemotherapy with durvalumab and olaparib, had a hazard ratio of 0.78 over that of durvalumab alone. Again, suggesting that there may be a role of adding PARPs into this setting. Another trial, RUBY Part 2. Now, the difference here is, in the DUO-E, the three arms were randomized and accrued at the same time. Part 2 happened after the fact. We added it onto the study after we were doing the head-to-head IO versus placebo with the chemotherapy. But here we wanted to look at what was the effect of niraparib in addition to dostarlimab in this population of patients. The first thing we'll say, and I think we talked about a recurrent theme here, is some of these trials don't have the right arms or don't have the additional arms. It's really tough to look at these two curves without a curve of chemotherapy with dostarlimab alone. But when we add in the PMMR setting, adding dostarlimab, niraparib, and chemotherapy versus chemotherapy alone, we had a hazard ratio of 0.63, which was statistically significant. Now why is this? What can we do to predict why? Do we need PARP inhibitors, or is it IO alone? This is all preliminary data. This was presented in 2023 by Mansoor Mirza in the RUBY trial. You know, in endometrial cancer, we do four molecular subclassifications to give us a better idea how they're going to respond. If I want you to focus on the Kaplan-Meier curve on the lower left. in the P53 mutated group, we could see that the dostarlimab with the chemotherapy seems to have the most effect in this population of tumors, the P53 mutated, not as much in NSMPs, and I'll talk about that population briefly. Now, this is the data from the DUO-E, which is a little bit contradictory. When you looked at the P53 mutated patients, while there was no difference with the durvalumab, okay, as it crossed one, as suggested as there should be in the RUBY trial, there was no difference here. But looking at this now with the olaparib and durvalumab, you could see in the P53 mutated group, and I'm sorry I don't have the box there. Dave has to show me how to do that. He did it very nicely. In the TP53 mutated group, it is statistically significant. So in this population of patients, is it the PARP or is the IO or is the combination of both? And clearly we need to do more and more studies looking at this. So can I say IO for all patients? Not so fast, right? In the PMMR population, while it has the FDA approval, we're still maybe a subpopulation of patients that need to do better, particularly this population of patients in the lower right, the NSMPs, or the P53 wild-type tumors. Selinexor is a nuclear transport inhibitor. It basically helps to keep P53 functioning inside the nucleus of the tumor. It's a simple way of doing it. We did a maintenance trial, the SIENDO trial, comparing adding selinexor versus placebo in the maintenance setting. All-comer population, it was a negative trial. However, looking at the subpopulations, focusing on the curve on the left, there was a statistically significant difference, a hazard ratio of 0.44, with the benefit of selinexor in this population of patients. Not enough data to get a regulatory approval at this point, but what it did is it set up for the next randomized phase 3 trial, which we're currently running through the GOG, the export trial, just for the P53 mutated patients, to see if we could replicate that difference with selinexor in the maintenance setting over placebo alone. This, in fact, may help give us a better idea of what to do in the P53 mutated patients. Maybe it's not the IO what we need. Let's switch gears now for the last couple of minutes over to cervical cancer, two trials that we really want to focus on. Here's the NGOT CX11, GOG3047, or widely known as the A18 Keynote trial, randomized phase 3 trial in those patients with locally advanced disease, traditionally treated with radiosensitizing whole pelvic radiotherapy with cisplatinum. And here what we did is we added pembrolizumab versus placebo, 5 cycles with the chemo radiation followed by 15 cycles afterwards. At the first interim analysis, the progression-free survival was statistically significant with a hazard ratio of 0.7, showing the activity of adding pembrolizumab. And we've previously demonstrated similar endometrial cancer that IO worked in cervical cancer patients. While this is the overall survival shown, this is the IA2 of progression-free survival, hazard ratio of 0.68, it maintained its difference. At the first interim analysis, the overall survival data was immature, not statistically significant, but when we moved to the second interim analysis, we saw the difference in overall survival. So how is that changing my practice? I truly believe that IO, early on in the locally advanced cancers, giving it with the chemotherapy and the radiation, we could see here has a benefit in the overall survival. This is the history of how we got here. It's always humbling to be on stage with Brad because he was heavily involved with a lot of these trials, showing how we went from chemo to adding bevacizumab to what's next, KEYNOTE-826. In the last minute, I'll go through this. This is a patient now, a trial now with first-line metastatic disease, widely metastatic disease, either recurrent outside the pelvis or in those patients newly diagnosed outside the pelvis. Adding the 4 drugs, carboplatin, paclitaxel, bevacizumab with the IO agent. Ketta LaRusso led this trial, randomized phase 3 trial. Here's the data here. In the protocol-specified final PFS analysis, adding in for those patients with a CPS greater than 1, we could see here that the medians were 10.5 versus 8.2, a hazard ratio of 0.5. And in the all-comer population, similarly, a hazard ratio of 0.61, demonstrating a benefit of the quadruplet. It took a while for us to incorporate this into practice. I think at first, people, including myself, were afraid of giving 4. They were talking about 5. We were afraid of giving 4 over 3, but we realized that it is something that the patients can tolerate, and we clearly see a benefit here. Overall survival, we're also seeing this benefit with a hazard ratio of 0.6 in the CPS greater than 1 population and a hazard ratio of 0.63 in all comers. That's what I have. Thanks, Neil.
Good
John.
So, you know, I'm thinking sometimes when so much stuff's coming at you, in a way, it's kind of like meditation to get your mind off there. Just try to concentrate enough on what they're talking about. It just clears your brain. Okay, let's try to bring it back to clinical reality. So, Dave, you're one of the people I turn to when it gets to mechanism of action and diagrams and things like that that I don't understand. So can you explain to me in like just words and your hands maybe how you envision how Selinexor works and why it should work better in P53 wild type? And while you're at it, like what you do in terms of tolerability, you know, we've heard a lot of stories from myeloma about it being challenging, but yet they figure out a way to use it.
Well, let's start with the easier question, which is the dosing is much different than melanoma. Myeloma, excuse me. So when we're looking at that, I mean, I forget where they use in myeloma. So it's much more easily tolerated in our maintenance trial. So when we look at this, now we had this conversation right when the results were released. How do you have the P53 wild type? Because you need that delivery within the cell, and if that is active, you actually have that is in that instance how we see the drug work, is the theory, right? So the reality is the mechanism of action, the reason you asked me is because you know I'm the dumbest person on the stage and I try to make it simple, right? I'll admit that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I think as we look at this, it's absolutely. So, you know, in that group of patients, we should be testing P53 on everybody in the future. If this trial confirms the problem in the current trial, is we're missing the correct control arm, which is against carboplatin paclitaxel plus IO.
Right.
And we'll have to do a trial comparison like we always aren't supposed to do. And that's all we do.
Yeah, just to add to that, I agree with Dave's right. In the current trial, we did see some toxicity with Siendo. We've lowered the dose a little bit, and we've required double antiemetic, which is helping out in the current trial patients.
Yeah, we're only using 60 in Export EC.
And what's the myeloma? It's 100, right?
No, it's 100, 110. I don't remember.
Yeah, it's less than half. I mean, we're at half.
Yeah, and we did 80 in Siendo.
Okay, another real-world question. MSI-high endometrial cancer, Brian. So tomorrow morning, we're going to talk about the fact that we're seeing more and more neoadjuvant IO of localized disease, rectal cancer, a famous study out of Memorial where they had 100% path CR. That's sure. All they're getting. Now, colon cancer also, they're seeing very dramatic responses. So first, is that being looked at in endometrial cancer, using it up front? And second, if you have somebody with metastatic disease, are you going to use IO plus chemo, IO alone? And then what about, like ipi-nivo, anti-CTLA-4, and PD-1?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. One of my career hopes is to get rid of chemotherapy for the management of this disease. And you mentioned the data from Memorial. You mentioned the KEYNOTE-177 in colorectal. So there's two studies in the dMMR microsatellite instability patients. One that I'm actually leading globally. It's the it's using pembrolizumab versus chemotherapy for the dMMR patients with the hope to get rid of the chemotherapy there. And that's actually close to accrual, the C93 trial, but it has not read out yet. Similarly, looking at dostarlimab is the Dominica trial, which is done by our European colleagues, which is ongoing still to accrual. Now, the problem with those studies is that they started before this date I mentioned in March of 2023, before the standard became carboplatin and paclitaxel with IO. So these studies are comparing it just to chemotherapy. It'll be a cross-trial comparison once the data's out. We'll have to see what the hazard ratios are. But if they're compelling, it may allow for IO alone in all, if not in some of the patients. But baby steps in getting rid of chemotherapy in this population.
Dave?
Well, in that subpopulation of patients, I mean, are the Lynch patients, the germline mutation, are those ones are more apt versus those that have just dMMR based on our IHC? So I think there were...
What's the difference again? They respond better?
I don't know.
There's no difference.
I don't know that, right?
GY01A showed that there was no difference. So the existing data suggests that whether it's germline or somatic...
When we looked at that subpopulation, but I think when you have an untreated population of patients, mm-hmm. you know, that we may see some difference. So is there a group of patients that we can substitute IO, but once again, we have the wrong control arm on
C93.
That's
right.
So we're going to have to do that cross-trial comparison. And my hope is that I don't think the entire population will be an IO only, but there may be subpopulations which we feel more comfortable, you know, moving forward.
But right now, you're going to use chemo?
Yeah. Carboplatin and paclitaxel is a very good regimen.
50-60% response rate.
It's very good.
And then when you add IO to it, in the DMMR, as Brian, nice job, my friend, it's a no-brainer. But even in the PMMR, non-MSI, there is a statistically significant, clinically relevant, FDA-approved option.
So one of the audience, Brian, wants to know more about tisotumab, vedotin, and I'm curious about your clinical experience with it. Also, the ophthalmic toxicity, do you put the ice on the eye? Uh-huh. And then they brought up an interesting question. If a patient with cervical cancer is HER2 positive, what comes first, tisotumab or T-DXd?
You know, that's a great question. Fortunately, you know, I've done a lot of work first in the first-in-human trials, and then through the GOG trial when we were involved with the innovative trial. A game changer, right? We needed, became a game changer to become the standard second line therapy for two reasons. The trial we did was second and third line, but during that trial, IO moved to the first line. So it left a wide open space and unmet need in the second line. Overall survival benefit, a progression-free survival benefit. This control arms were chemotherapy. We know that chemotherapy and the second line therapy for cervical cancer really doesn't work. So as far as the ocular toxicity, we saw that a lot in the earlier studies. Then what we started doing is more aggressive ocular mitigation strategies, requiring ophthalmologic evaluation, requiring the eye drops, not allowing for contact lenses. And what we see, that became much more tolerable, to the point that we're seeing very, very little ocular toxicity, at least now in practice. And not only that, when we do see it, it's often lower grade and it resolves on its own.
Dave, what's your experience? You use the ice packs?
Yeah, we use the ice packs. We use the drops. The moisturizing eye drops are the most important, and to avoid things like contact lenses. But you know, I was able to get our order set to say ophthalmology examination recommended, not required, and that's a very different. Many of these patient populations have a lot of challenges just getting in to receive their therapy. Many of them are under-resourced. And so the difference between conjunctivitis with TV versus, you know, a MERV that has, you know, it's not conjunctivitis. You see the visual changes, the corneal changes. You need that slit lamp examination. Patient walks in with TV, it's pretty obvious they're having eye toxicity. Their eyes are red, right? So it's like, okay, we need to get you. Now we need to get you into somebody. So am I advocating that going against the label? No. Am I advocating being practical and making sure our patients have the necessary support to get the drug? Yes. And it really is not a big deal. So many of our drugs now have eye toxicities. We literally hand them the form when they come in for their visit and say, take this to your eye doctor, and they can take a picture, upload it, or they bring it back to us in their next visit.
I was telling the audience last night, we're about to do our third CME program on ophthalmic issues in oncology. There's so many drugs with eye issues. Yep. You had a comment?
Yeah, I was going to say, so we're ADC doctors, and I don't think that topoisomerase payload after topoisomerase payload is a great idea. Tisotumab vedotin, cervical cancer, tissue factor is an MMAE antitubulin. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is a topoisomerase. So it's really a sequencing issue, and both are good options. And for a 3+, probably better than TV. For 2+, it's a close call, but either way, the patient hopefully will get both medications.
Have you seen useful responses to tisotumab?
100%.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, 24%.
No, but I mean, if you...
Yes.
You know, yeah. I just need to hear about a few cases to get me excited.
No, yeah, and stabilization as well, right? That's the objective response rate. And in Professor Slomovitz is last author of the New England Journal of the definitive paper, so just saying.
And not only that, Neil, not only the responses we're seeing, when I sort of see the response sort of slowing down and maybe a little bit of minimal growth, there's really good data on combining these agents. So I'll have them on TV, and then I'll add pembrolizumab to hopefully get another kickstart later on if I see less of a response. And clinically, it's panning out.
So two things. So the NCCN guidelines in cervical cancer were updated on February 10. The two substantial changes were, number one, pembro, tisotumab vedotin. Yes, Brian. Number two, in A18, the pembro plus chemotherapy and radiation was sort of ambiguous. And if it has sidewall involvement, ureteral involvement, bladder rectal involvement, it's preferred, just what you said. But if it's just nodal positive, now it's a 2B. So you could say to the insurance company for the lower risk still enrolled in the trial that it is NCCN recommended. Now you may say 2B doesn't carry the reimbursement, float the reimbursement boat, but it's very clear in the February 10 NCCN update that yes, in the node positive, lower risk, A18, pembro chemotherapy radiation, that it is an option.
And A18 is one. A18 is probably the one trial that I actually pull out the Kaplan-Meier curves when I'm counseling a patient and flip around the computer and say, you know, real difference here is about 10% that you're going to increase your curative intent. And again, once patients with cervix cancer recur, just heard, the options are really limited. Mm-hmm. So I really say, this is where we are. We're going to try to get you on this curb. It's the one time I just flip that computer around and show them the KMs.
So, Brian, question from the audience. I have a hard time pronouncing it. I'll call it RDXD. Mm-hmm. The question is, again, have you seen meaningful responses? You know, sometimes just hearing about a few patients is enough to get people interested. Have you seen useful responses?
You know, I haven't really been using it that much in this population.
Dave, endometrial just care. Coming out. It's just we're just getting started, so we're going to wait and see. But obviously, the concept with the topo and isomerase payload, we're very excited. We got to get the more experience.
So that medication was developed here through Florida Cancer. Philip Filipowski is a lead investigator, and that study is open. Even though he's a DDU guy, that phase 3 trial is open in the north in the Orlando region here. The rest of the state is doing the RENA-S next generation topoisomerase folate receptor alpha, which is biomarker agnostic. So MIRV, again, a tubulin payload, but RENA-S, the Genmab medication, is a topoisomerase, and that we're also doing the accelerated approval single arm study in the randomized trial, which is called Rainfall, will be open in the east and in the south by Grancial and me. So Rainfall, RENA-S, folate receptor alpha topoisomerase is probably going to be the next ADC to get approved in ovarian cancer.
We're going to need a lot more of these talks, Neil, a lot more.
One thing to highlight, it was mentioned, Barrett said it's an ADC world now. The problem is, how long is it going to last? Because we're talking about topo one after, topo one and all of these payloads. Is there a role for topo one after topo one? We're not investigating it yet in GYN.
Right.
And it may be a one and done. So I'm excited about the recurrent results in the studies that are being planned out, looking at maybe in the first line. Maybe all these second line trials are going to go away because we'll use it in the first line. And then what's the role afterwards?
And what these guys are doing, they're trying to do radioligand solid tumor. That's the next version. They're trying to do T-cell bispecific CD3 T-cell engagers. So we have a whole program in bispecific research in solid tumors, and tarlatamab in small cell lung cancer, and also the radioligand, which was led by Novartis in prostate, PSMA positive. So we're looking for the next best thing beyond ADCs and GYN and other solid tumors.
So you're looking at CD3 bispecifics in which gynecologic cancers?
It's non-disclosed.
Well, no, we can say we can say that what is publicly available is Regeneron has their ovarian cancer portfolio.
MUC1, mesothelin.
Thank you. And the CD3, we presented that data a couple of times, and they have actually, I don't know if they've said that publicly, so I'll stop there.
Yep.
All right.
But that's the next best thing in solid tumors, I think, radioligands and T-cell engagers, because we're exhausting the antibody-drug conjugate landscape.
All right. Thank you very much.